This episode is sponsored by our good friends at Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code EXAMINED. A better web starts with your website.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 101 is something like, what is God? And we'll be discussing selections from The Guide for the Perplexed by Moses Maimonides, completed in 1168. You can join the discussion, get a link to the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer talking to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, being a unity of substance without attributes in Austin, Texas.
This is Danny Lobel in Los Angeles, California.
Welcome, Danny.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to be on the show.
It is a pleasure to have you.
So probably between the two of us, Seth and I add up to one Carl Reiner, right?
Well, you know, I'm really impressed by you guys. I listen to your podcast every now and then, and I'm always like, okay, these guys are really doing it. You know, I'm trying, but you guys are masters. I feel like I told you I'm intimidated kind of coming on because I'm going to look like the idiot that I am, but that's okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what your project is that you're doing so we can familiarize you to the listeners?
Well, what I do is a sort of like an intro to philosophy podcast. It doesn't go as in depth as what you guys are doing, but I've heard a lot of times people have called comedians modern day philosophers. I used to work for Jackie Mason. Jackie Mason's one of these guys from that generation that wouldn't give it up for any of his peers until they were dead, you know? So anytime you'd ask, like, he introduced me to George Carlin. And every time I'd say, like, oh, George Carlin's phenomenal. You know, George Carlin's coming by the college to do my radio show, or I talked to Carlin last night, and he'd be like, oh, my God, you talked to Carlin. Such a big deal. You talked to Carlin. Like, he goes, what are you so worried about the fact George Carlin? He goes, he's not even funny anymore. You know, he's just vulgarity and filth. Who knows what the hell he's even talking about? He's a depressive. He'd just go on, and I just couldn't talk to him about Carlin, and he the day that George Carlin died, first thing in the morning, I got a call from Jackie Mason. Oh, my God, we lost the greatest comedian who ever lived. He was more than just a comedian. He was a modern-day philosopher. And that was the first time I'd heard that. And I've heard it a bunch of times since. I started thinking about the guys that I loved because I was hitting a wall as a writer and as a comedian, and I was feeling like, I'm not sure why I'm doing this anymore. And I had to get back to what I loved about it, and I started really thinking about the guys who I loved, which were George Carlin and Patrice O'Neill, who I thought were both brilliant philosophers as well. And I realized that it's really the philosophy element of comedy that I'm very strongly attracted to. Sure, I love to be funny and I love writing a good joke and finding a good misdirection or a nice punchline, and everybody's addicted to a laugh. But I really wanted to kind of tap into why I was doing it and what I should be gearing towards. And I stopped writing jokes and I started writing stories more and talking about my feelings on things. And I started putting me into my work. Then I started thinking, I really am into philosophy. And I was in therapy and I was talking about, I have to clarify that I wasn't suicidal, but I was at a point in my life where I just couldn't remember why I was excited to be alive. Does that make sense?
Of course.
Yep.
And I was like, I don't know what my passions are. And then I started thinking, you know, I started telling the therapist, you know, I really dig like philosophy and comedy. I think that's why I like it. And I wish I would have paid attention in school and I would have took in the philosophy, and I'd love to learn philosophy. And she sort of said, well, what's stopping you? You do that if you're into it. And I kind of clicked and I said, yeah, I could do that. So I went and I actually got the book that we're going to discuss a little bit today. I picked up this copy here.
Massive tome. Tiny print.
Yeah, tiny print. As a Jew, I figured I should start with our dude, Moses Maimonides. Or Moses ben Maimon, the Rambam Maimonides.
I love that, the Rambam.
Which I think is a cool name for a kid. If I ever have a boy, I'm going to try. Maybe I'll name him Rambam.
Rambam. No, name him the Rambam. That is how.
Because all the rabbis in that era, which we call the Gedolim, which means the giants of learning Torah, these guys all had like superhero nicknames. So there was like the Riv and the Rav and the Rashi and the Rambam, and then there was his contemporary, the Ramban, Nachmanides. They all had like, you know, real names and fake names, like the Chafetz Chaim. These aren't even real names. They were just like kind of like Batman or... And then the Gedolim, I kind of see that as like the Avengers or something, you know? It just kind of all blends together in my Jewish nerdiness and my comic book nerdiness.
Yeah, and the Pope is kind of like Thanos.
It could be. I couldn't get through this on my own, this Guide for the Perplexed.
Who could get through it? So I chose these sections based on a collection that I have just called Philosophy in the Middle Ages, which I was looking at syllabi. If you're having trouble figuring out what part of a book to read, just look online. What are they teaching? So somebody had used in a course, had used those exact same selections. So we use that as a starting point and kind of whittle down from there. And I will just read the sections. So if people want to read them on their own. So we read book one, chapters 51 through 53 and 57 through 60. Those focus on the nature of God for the most part. Book two, we looked at a little bit. Chapters 13 and 16 were the only ones that were left that are about, does time have a beginning, right? Was the earth created at some point? Was the whole universe created or is it eternal? And then we looked a little just to get some of the idea of the social aspects and as a launching point to talk a little bit about how Maimonides thinks that his philosophy is supposed to interact with his Judaism. We looked at book three, chapters 26 through 28, which talk a little bit about what is the purpose of the law. Are all the laws, do they have sense to them? If you're going to start, you know, he's very clear. The very first page of the first chapter of this book is about things in the Torah, about man being in God's image. Like it sounds like then we're supposed to be in God's image. That, in other words, that God must have arms and legs and a head and things like that. And he wants to take that as a launching point to say, no, actually, you have to read that and nearly everything else in the Bible, in the Torah, allegorically or non-literally or something, because he wants to argue that a proper understanding of God means that God is not anthropomorphic in any way. God is entirely unified. He's a unity. He's a simple. If you talk about somebody seeing God or God doing this or that or God loving this or that, like you mean it in a completely different way than when you're talking about a human being. Like, you know, it's at best, it's an allegory. And he comes down with his position, which he did not originate, of negative theology, that you can say negative things. You can say that he doesn't have a body, but you can't actually say even that he is incorporeal or that he is anything. Like you end up So, of course, that raises certain problems. And then the stuff about the eternity, the book two stuff it is related to that, right? That if God is a unity, that means, yeah, there couldn't have been anything that existed with him at the beginning before his creation came about. So it's not like he pre-existed with some clay and picked it up and made it into something.
Right. But also that the creation is therefore part of God. If God is a unity and there's a oneness to everything, then we too are God. We are an aspect of God.
Before we dive deep into that, let me just give a little context and some structure. I fear I'm a little scared to say this in front of Danny because it sounds like he's got a little more experience in Hebrew than I do. But
yeah, we should say you grew up in an Orthodox community, right?
Yeah, that's right. I went to yeshiva.
Okay. Well, in that case, now I'm terrified.
Don't be.
I'm the only non-Jew on the podcast today.
Believe me, as scared as you are, I'm double scared being on the podcast with you guys because...
Now, this will be the first and only time that Jew outnumbers Goy, I think, on this podcast. But this is from the introduction, the author's introduction to the book we're reading. My primary object in this work is to explain certain words occurring in the prophetic books. Of these, some are homonyms, and of their several meanings, the ignorant choose the wrong ones, or other terms which are employed in a figurative sense are erroneously taken by such persons in their primary signification. There are also hybrid terms denoting things which are of the same class from one point of view and from of a different class from another. And he says, essentially, the object of this treatise is to enlighten a religious man who has been trained to believe in the truth of our holy law, who conscientiously fulfills his moral and religious duties, and at the same time has been successful in his philosophical studies. I know that when Mark is reading this, I'm sure he's picking up on all the traditional philosophical, Aristotelian themes, scholastic themes that actually come probably out of the Arabic philosophical tradition.
Yes, Maimonides was contemporary with the end of that, and he lived in the Arabic world, right? Yep. In Morocco and Egypt.
Right, he came from Spain, and he was chased out of Spain into Morocco, into, I believe, Fez, Morocco, mm-hmm. and then he wound up in Egypt, and he became the physician to the...
to the vizier of Saladin.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's a very interesting character that's blending scholastic tradition, Aristotelianism, very, very strong and steep rabbinical Judaism, and is also culturally, having lived in Spain and then Morocco and then Egypt, picking up, because he was also a doctor. The reason he was the personal physician, actually, to the vizier, and served as a doctor, so he actually knew a lot about Galen and a bunch of others. And so there are a number of things that are going on in this text, some of which are sort of traditional philosophical arguments, talking about substance and attribute, the kind of language that all the philosophy folks would recognize. But he's also working out of this rabbinical tradition where there's a whole different form of exegesis of the text, where it's expected to analyze what you might call the literal or the surface meaning of the text, and then go into the deeper metaphorical, allegorical.
The secret meaning.
The secret meanings, the hidden meanings or the comparative meanings. So there's a lot of language play that modern people would probably associate more with what we would call contemporary continental philosophy and be somewhat dismissive of it. But because this is Jewish and it's Hebrew, we can get away with it. But anyway, I would encourage people to be open to lots of different things that are going on in the text.
This book was very, very controversial when it came out. The Ashkenazic Jews, which were the Jews generally of Eastern Europe, opposed to the Sephardic Jews, which were the Spanish, Portuguese, Moroccan Jews. And so the Rambam comes from the Sephardic tradition. The Ashkenazic Jews, they burned his books when they came out, first of all, because they referenced Aristotle, the Guide for the Perplexed, is kind of an answer in many ways to the other philosophers of his time. And a lot of it is to clarify, I think a lot of people were being influenced at the time by Aristotle, and Maimonides wanted to sort of provide the Jewish community with some answers to these questions that they had. And he realized there was a need for a voice to answer these. But it was very controversial when it came out because the other rabbis of the Ashkenazic tradition felt that you shouldn't even be validating him to mention him in a book about Torah.
Yeah, I think the objection was sort of in general to philosophy, that you shouldn't be using, you know, self-evident reason, which is, you know, something that's accessible to everybody, as a basis for anything. And there's sort of, I think there's a lot of scholarly dispute about where Maimonides' loyalty ultimately lies. He's a rationalist, he's trying to just use reason and then make the Torah fit with that, or is he ultimately accepting, well, I mean, he explicitly said, it was actually kind of influential in one of his earlier works, here the, what, 16 articles of faith for Judaism, that mm-hmm. I guess this was a fairly new thing to actually say. You just had to accept these, you know, the existence of God, for instance, on faith. But yet, it looks like in this book, there's a lot of places where at least some of those things, maybe not the scriptures, he doesn't argue, you know, that there's a self-evident from reason argument why you have to accept the scriptures. That's something you have to accept on faith. So the question is sort of where are you starting with? But for the normal reader, the reader today, the conflict is still alive. That you might say that, you know, you have to translate the Aristotelian science of his time into modern science now, but you could still be asking the question, you know, as any kind of religious person, how do I reconcile my faith, these scriptures, with what the smartest people around think today?
Right.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this, Mark, when you and I were talking earlier this week, that at least in my mind, the question's pretty settled about whether, you know, he felt more in the rationalist camp or more in the rabbinical tradition, in the sense that the hermeneutical exercise that he's undertaking is to use reason not so much to justify articles of faith, but rather use reason in the service of rationalizing what is in the revealed word of God with the scientific facts and such that existed at the time, but also to use the exercise of intellect as a supplement to the traditional rabbinical exegesis methods to justify many of the articles of faith, if you will, or commandments that he saw in the Bible. And the part of the reason why, which he explains in the section that we read on negative theology, which we'll get to, is essentially that the more that you can bring to bear evidence for your faith or for your knowledge of God, the more you can bring those to bear, the stronger your faith is, the better your knowledge of God is, and ultimately the closer you are to perfection, because that's ultimately the purpose of human existence, at least as far as being a seeker of God, is to seek to perfection, which is knowledge of God, and reason is just another thing that you can bring to bear to gain that perfection.
Well, and you're drawing a connection to the other major Jewish philosophers that we've hit on the podcast that we talked about. Martin Buber, the most recent one, an existentialist, not really relevant to this, but Spinoza, you know, from the Enlightenment period, very much relevant to this, very much compared. And he also was, like Maimonides, very high on reason. And in fact, had a very similar, from what I understand, this is not in what part of what we read today, view of the afterlife as something to do with your continued partaking of unity with reason itself or something like that. I don't even know the whole story here, but it has something to do with your reasoning faculty, right? It's not that everybody, after they die, then that you sit around in heaven or something like that. It's that you can, insofar as you are a reasonable person, and this is more Spinoza's view, which I actually know, can partake in the universal and thereby live eternally, right? Because reason, God, is kind of outside of space and time and the universe. And so insofar as you are reasonable, you too are transcending everyday human existence. In fact, one of the things I looked at even compared this lesson to the book of Job, right? The point of the book of Job, where this guy gets tortured, you know, loses his whole family, loses his crops, loses everything, that the whole point of that was to turn him toward the universal, toward the eternal things. That's what you should be focusing on, not things that can die away. Those things, anything that can die away is going to die away. You got to look to the eternal. And so that's where reason comes in. So, right, both Spinoza and Maimonides were, and you could probably look at Plato and other folks like that, were right in that camp of glorifying reason.
I think what really separated Spinoza from Maimonides in a big way was their view on God. Spinoza looked at God more as nature, right? And not necessarily as having an interest in our in what we do. Whereas Maimonides was saying, no, there are consequences to what you do. God is very involved in your life in that way. It's God is not limited to nature. We can't understand God. We can't give God a shape or a form. Am I on the right track there?
So I think this is a really good contrast to pick apart, because you know, whether or not you have any religious sentiments at all, I think it's useful to think about, if you do believe in God, what follows from the concept, right? The question for today is sort of, what is God? And for me as an atheist, you know, I brought up another podcast here that just the whole definition, the whole idea of God seems self-contradictory. That as soon as you come up with an idea, a question like, can God make a sandwich bigger than God can eat? Then you're saying that there's something about the concept of all-powerful that is self-contradictory, that there can't be anything that's all-powerful because that would involve absurdities. Yes, he can both eat the sandwich, and yes, he can both make the sandwich that's bigger than he can eat. You know, so, and you can point at all these other different contradictions in the concept like that. Well, putting aside the specifics of any particular theology, what makes sense if you really think that there is some being that somehow is the ground of everything? And one of the ways of doing that is Spinoza's, which actually does capture what you said, Danny, before, that nature, the created things end up being part of God for Spinoza. God can still transcend those. God is both mind, he can think, and somewhat comparable to the way we can think. In fact, like I was saying before, insofar as we are reasoning, then we partake of God, of the eternal. Folks can go back and listen to our actual Spinoza episode for the details of this to make sense. But God ends up being something that definitely is everything, right? He's often called a pantheist because it's like God is in everything. But don't mistake it for the kind of pantheism that says God is just nature, right? Spinoza is open to God transcending anything that we can have possible experience of. It's just, because God is everything, he has to include all the stuff that we do experience, the stuff that we do see and feel and touch. Whereas Maimonides, I think, contrary to what you said, Danny, the creation is separate from God. God has to be something that is singular, is unitary. So if we were all part of God, that would mean God has parts. Well, God does not have parts. God is something that's beyond all that.
Right, but wouldn't all those things encompassed be not necessarily as parts, but... Well, I guess if everything is one thing, then it's you don't need to call it parts anymore, right? You don't need to break it down into little pieces.
I think you guys are on the right path. Maimonides' notion of the unity of God versus Spinoza's notion of the unity of God, that's definitely one place where there's a clear differentiation. So why don't we spell out what Maimonides' concept of unity is?
And by the way, Seth, they both got ostracized by the rabbis in their time.
That is correct. One of them, though, had a bit more cred.
Yeah. Maimonides held up more than Spinoza in terms of religious Judaism today.
Absolutely.
Right. And wasn't somebody just telling us that it was only recently that the descendants of the organization that ostracized Spinoza are just going through a process now as to whether to revoke his excommunication?
Yeah. I told you that when I came up to Wisconsin. Yes. There's a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and the Jewish community in Amsterdam that excommunicated him is investigating, and they called on Spinoza scholars around the world to give their opinion.
Right.
There's a little 10-minute podcast on Wisconsin Public Radio if you guys are interested.
Yeah, as opposed to Maimonides, who is his canon, is his, the Mishnah Torah? Is that what it was called? The second Torah. So the book that he wrote before this one, which was just a collection of, here's all Jewish law. You don't have to hunt through all these different volumes of the Talmud and the commentaries and the other things to figure out what kind of sacrifices you should make, which even at the time he was writing, people weren't really making sacrifices, but you know, or what you're allowed to eat on what day. I'm just going to put it in one book for you. So he kind of established himself, and that is accepted right now, right? As pretty much part of the canon,
right?
That if you want to know what old time Judaism says, you go look at that first.
It's kind of the Torah for dummies, almost. Smart dummies, but yeah, the Mishnah Torah kind of broke it down all very simplified. Oh, you want to know, what do you do in this situation? Well, you do this. And also, I think it had to do with the oral tradition. See, in Judaism, we have the written tradition and the oral tradition of the Torah, which the belief is that they were both passed down to Moses on Sinai. And without one, the other can't be translated. And the idea was that if you just read the Bible as it was, the Torah, it would sound like child stories without the oral tradition, which is why when the Romans, I think it was the Romans or the Greeks that forced the rabbis to translate the Torah for them into Latin, they didn't give them the oral tradition. They only gave them the written tradition, which is why there are a lot more explanations and there's a lot more you can derive out of different passages in the Bible in Jewish study, from what I understand, than you can in Catholicism. Because they don't have that oral tradition. They were only given, in terms of what they consider the Old Testament, they were only given the written tradition.
So is that the same as, you know, when I was making fun of the secret meaning? That's sort of what I had been led to believe in some of the podcasts and stuff I was listening about Maimonides while prepping for this, was that the literal sense of the Bible stories, you know, that talk about the face of God and the hand of God, right, and I talk to God and all the stuff that Maimonides wants to deny is literally true, that, like Maimonides says many times, you know, the Torah is written in the language of the people, something like that.
Right.
You know, these are stories, these child stories, like you say, that's the level that he thinks most people need to understand. And in fact, if you explained the, I don't know if this is equivalent to the oral tradition, but if you explained the esoteric meaning, if you explained the secret meaning to them, it would just confuse them. It would screw them up. In fact, this whole book, or reading natural philosophy at all, this is the root of partly what these people objecting to Maimonides that you referred to were objecting to philosophy in general, is because, you know, you just stick to the book. Don't think too much beyond this. You know, Maimonides very much did not want to aim this at everybody. This guy for the perplexed, you know, he's actually in violation of this code against writing down the secret teachings by writing this at all. But he just thought, well, you know, somebody's got to explain this, so I'll break the law a little bit here.
He realized they were getting lost. Generation to generation, they were getting lost. And with people being killed, you know, the Jews were, we've always been very killable people. So he was afraid that these traditions and these understandings were getting lost, like deciphering the code. Like you said earlier, all the stories are meant to be allegorical. You were talking a little bit about Job. I think the common opinion amongst religious Jews is that that whole story never happened. The whole story of Job is a metaphor. It's just there to learn things from. There are 8 opinions, I believe, on what period of time Job lived in. And the 8th opinion is that he never lived in any time at all, and that it was completely made up just to derive interesting lessons from. And that's, I think, the most common one that's held by, that that story never happened. And the other stories like Jonah and all these, they're kind of written in code. They're there so that they'll grasp a child's interest because they're good bedtime stories. And then from there, you can get deeper and deeper and deeper into them as you become more of a scholar. And the Torah is meant so that an 80-year-old can enjoy it and a 5-year-old can enjoy it, learning it. That's the idea.
Right. At the different levels. And Maimonides definitely felt like, you know, you had to be at a certain point to even grasp philosophy. It's not for everybody, but he did think that even the regular people, they needed to get the idea that God does not have a body, that God does not look like a guy with a beard. That if you're worshiping a guy with a beard, according to Maimonides, even if you use all the right words and you call it God, you are actually participating in idolatry. You're breaking the first commandment.
Yeah. He's saying you cannot give any physical attributions to God at all, and that all comes from people taking these stories literally.
But maybe we should spend a little time on the philosophical underpinning of that of that concern, this idea of unity and plurality.
So I'm sure we're working with about 3 different translations here. I'm going to read from the one in my Philosophy in the Middle Ages book just because it's
because you like to do that.
Every time it uses God or even his, you know, like with a capital H or he, mm-hmm. it adds, may he be exalted. So it's like every other sentence.
Mm-hmm.
He, may he be exalted, is similarly composed of various notions, namely his essence, you know. That was deleted from the translation on the wiki source that I will link folks to. So let's just get a flavor for this. So the beginning of book 1, chapter 51, which is the first thing that we officially read. There are many things in existence that are clear and manifest. Primary intelligibles and things perceived by the senses, and in addition, the things that come near to these in respect to their clarity. If man had been left as he naturally is, he would not have needed a proof of them. For instance, the existence of motion, the existence of man's ability to act, the manifestations of generation and corruption, the natures of things that are apparent to the senses, like the hotness of fire, the coldness of water, many things of this kind. Yet since strange opinions have arisen, do either to people who committed errors, or to people who acted with some end of view, so that professing such opinions, they ran counter to the nature of existence and denied a sensibly perceived things, or wished to suggest to the estimative faculty the existence of a non-existent thing, the men of science have had to resort to proving those manifest things and to disproving the existence of things that are only thought to exist. And some of the things that are only thought to exist, he says, thus we may find that Aristotle establishes the fact of motion as it had been denied and demonstrates the non-existence of atoms as their existence had been asserted.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to get as far as that example that, you know, according to, yeah, okay, Democritus, guys like that invented the idea of the atom, but at least the science prevailing at the time with Aristotle in the forefront did not think that there were, you know, this is at least not the atoms as science looks at them now, you know, which you can break into quarks and then who the hell knows what you can break the quarks into or if you can break the quarks or maybe there's pieces of superstring, you know, that's, it's not the final word, but the old time theory of atoms was just that the fundamental ontology of the universe is little tiny things, little tinker toy things that then fit together in various ways. The atoms is the ultimate particles of everything. You could see why Maimonides would not be down with that, right? He has to at least have God be this unity, this superstructure that underlies everything that is needed. You couldn't just have atoms floating there in the air. You'd need, for any matter of any sort, you need this underlying support of God.
Mark, that same section that you just referenced, the next paragraph immediately leads to where this is going to go with respect to the unity of God. And he says, this will be a radically different translation. To the same class belongs the rejection of essential attributes in reference to God, for it is a self-evident truth that the attribute is not inherent in the object to which it is ascribed, but it is superadded to its essence and is consequently an accident. If the attribute denoted the essence, toti no eni, right, of the object, it would be either a mere tautology, as if, for example, one would say man is man, or the explanation of a name, as in, for example, man is a speaking animal. For the words speaking animal include the true essence of man, and there is no third element besides life and speech in the definition of man. I added that last part just because I like that. But basically, you can see where this is going to go, which is essentially to say, if you think of God as being some kind of substance that has attributes, then you're suggesting that those attributes are somehow not part of God. They're super added. They're accidental, not essential. And to say that God somehow doesn't have what you would consider to be an attribute, that it's something that's added to his nature, would be to diminish the concept of God. And so he's going to spend the next few chapters teasing that out, what that means, which is essentially to say God can't have attributes at all. And yet you also can't say of God that there's any particular thing which is essential to him. Essentially, everything is essential to God, right?
Wasn't he then talking about how man was created in the image of God refers to his essence?
Man's essence, yes. The rationality somehow has to connect to God.
And then he said, in that way, you can give God an attribute, but not any kind of physical attribute, but one of intellect and one of, I'm just looking at my notes here, God is one of simple substance, and that by calling God's attributes an accident is denying his existence. But conversely, what I understood from this was that he was saying, when you talk about rational thinking, if you are of clear mind and intellect, that is essentially what is being referred to as in the image of God.
That is right. I mean, that's what I was talking about in terms of his view of immortality and how it's close to Spinoza's, that whole emphasis on rationality. So I think there are some steps that he goes through to get to the ultimate negative theology. So the thesis of negative theology is just that there's nothing positive you can say about God. And I don't mean there's nothing, you can't say God's right. Nice. I'm not saying positive in that sense. I'm saying there is nothing.
He's got
at
a
all.
Sweet disposition. He keeps his lawn up.
Great hair.
Nice to dogs. Great hair.
So you can't say what God is, but you can say what God is not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very weird to us because it seems like by basic logic, if you're saying God is not this, then you're saying God has the property of not this. You know, mm-hmm. You're giving him a positive. You could rename the property not this and call it that.
Right.
And you're saying God is that. And we've already said God is a unity. That's attributing a property to God. But he wants to say even that. Ultimately, all we know is that God is not plural. Mm-hmm. And what he's really trying to say, I think he uses this some language, we can find an appropriate quote as we go through this, is that he's not of the right category. It's like if you say, my words are not green.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then you're not saying that my words are some color other than green, because words don't have colors. So if you say God is not divided, God is not weak, God is not evil, mm-hmm. then you are not saying God is strong and good and unified in ways that we understand, in ways that we could talk about this or that object that I can hold in my hand being unified, or this person I know as being wise or good or something. Because really, God is in a different category completely than those things.
Yeah.
So that's the weird part. Let's take the steps to get there. And the way he starts here is with the quote you gave, Zach.
And Mark, doesn't he go on to, I don't think it's in this chapter, but he goes on to talk about how God is not affected by space or time. So is his opinion thus that it's God plus the universe? Or is God also the universe? In which case, how do we differentiate that from Spinoza?
Right. That's what I've been arguing, is that it's not the latter. It's not that the universe is God. It becomes a problem as soon as you adopt a position of negative theology. Well, what is our relation to God? Because, okay, I don't want to jump ahead here.
Yeah. And I think, Danny, you've posed an extremely difficult question. But I do think that Maimonides wants to make a distinction between God and God's creations, at least in some way, although I'm not claiming to understand it. I do think that he wants to say that there's a distinction between the two, which sounds weird because we're saying he's not a plurality. In which case you would kind of be forced into Spinoza's position. But
saying he's not a plurality is not the same thing as saying the universe, including him, is not a plurality. That is a plurality. It's just that plurality sounds like then we could count the things. We could say there's this table, there's this chair, there's me, there's you, and there's God, and God is one of the things. But he wants to say even that is not correct. The concept number does not apply to God.
Right.
Correct. Yeah. In fact, he says, there cannot be any belief in the unity of God except by admitting that he is one simple substance without any composition or plurality of elements. From whatever side you view it, whatever test you examine it, not divisible into two parts in any way by any cause, not capable of any form of plurality, either objectively or subjectively. Now, he's pointing specifically in this case, he's talking about plurality in this very formal sense around substance and attribute and essences. He wants to say there's a simple substance, single essence, no plurality, no accidental qualities that adhere, nothing you can ascribe to that simple substance. And this is kind of where I think some people have attributed to Maimonides this notion of like rational mysticism or intelligent mysticism, the idea that somehow God is capable of being and generating without having any of that stuff as accidental to him. It's hard. When he writes, it's very clear, but it's hard to grasp the concept.
Can we just, let's just make really clear what this whole deal about accidents is. So according to Aristotelian metaphysics, and he's kind of assuming that we know what that is.
Right.
Fundamentally, there are substances and there are attributes, and the substances have the attributes, and the attributes are either, they're actually called accidents. That's just another word for it. The way he's interpreting that, and I don't know how much of this is his interpretation or how much is this is straight from Aristotle. I'm guessing it's straight from Aristotle, that there's no such thing as a necessary property in the way that we might think of it today. So we've had, you know, more recent philosophers might say that all mathematics are necessary truths, or, you know, things necessarily exist in space and time or something like that. No, none of that. In fact, he says being in time is not only an accident, it's an accident of an accident.
But, right? Well, keep it simple, right? I mean, I have in front of me a black desk. It has extension, it has shape, it's made of metal, right? When we say like the desk is black, and I'm attributing the property of being black to the desk, that is an accidental property, meaning it's not necessary to the desk that it be black. It could be some other color.
And would still be a desk.
Mm-hmm. And so it's accidental in the sense that it's not necessary to the essence of the desk that it be the color black or the color red or whatever.
I interpreted it completely differently when I read it. Obviously, what you guys are saying is based on Aristotelian.
Well, give us your version.
Well, I was thinking about it in terms of like an atheist view of like we're all kind of here by accident. Like we don't have to be, in other words.
There's something to that.
Because it's not an accident that word is used in that way. Obviously, you know, who knows what the hell the etymology, like what Greek word accident is actually a translation of. You know, let's not get into the philological stuff like that. But right. So there's this idea in philosophy that there's some things that are necessary and there's some things that are contingent. And different philosophers may think different things are necessary and contingent. And a big point at issue here is about God, that if you take the Spinoza version of God, which actually Maimonides attributes this aspect of Spinoza, at least to Aristotle himself, is that everything God does is necessary. It just comes out of his nature, because you can't imagine God sort of sitting around and making a decision, having a whim to do this or that. That's straight up anthropomorphizing of the worst kind. So therefore, according to somebody like Aristotle or Spinoza, he doesn't have a personality and make decisions like that. Things happen because of the nature of God. And if you take it one step further, like Spinoza does, you say that actually the things that happen are chunks of God. Maimonides wants to resist that. We can't say God has necessary properties or accidental properties, or some of his actions are accidents. We can't say that.
Right.
Because those kind of terms, as we've been saying, just don't apply to God.
Right.
But he also wants to say that it is not the case that the created world is a necessary happenstance because of God's nature. Right? God actually did make a choice, whatever that means.
Yeah.
I'd love to use this excuse myself sometime, where it's like, well, why'd you do that, Danny? I don't make these decisions. These are just things that happen because I'm Danny.
That's the whole free will debate, yes. If you think the whole world is a bunch of dominoes lined up, you know, hitting each other, then, well, it all goes back and it has to be God's fault. So it's just nature. And Maimonides, as part of his broad picture of what he's arguing against, this Aristotelian scientific view that would rule out a personal God that in some way makes decisions. And even though he's not anthropomorphic, he's not anything like just a dude, but still there has to be some way that he could be giving us commands and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there's an interesting conversation there to be had about the notion of accidental as far as contingency that Danny raised, or possibility even. But I mean, in this context, Maimonides is saying you can't ascribe properties to God. You can't say that God is tall or short or all-knowing or all-powerful or merciful or vengeful. And these are really the critical things.
Because they're actually said in the Bible,
it actually
right?
says in the Bible, you know, I am a just God. I am an angry God. I am a vengeful God.
But that's what he's talking about when he's saying that it's written in the language of the people. It's trying to make it so that a simpleton would have an understanding of something that they would need a much deeper intellect to understand on a truer level.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So his explanation is this is something that we do. The Torah is written in the language of human beings. So we tell these stories, revealed though they are, inspired though they are, they're stories that we speak in our own language. And there's a whole fun thing about prophets and all that that we'll go into later, because Spinoza had the same view that I thought was interesting. And so even though the Bible says God is merciful, you have to go beyond that and say, well, we can't really say that God is merciful. To attribute mercy as a property to God is wrong. Now, the reason why we do it is because we see the actions, and this is kind of where the linkage comes, is that you can say God acted in this way, or God did this, or God did that, and because human beings do those similar kinds of things, and we impugn psychological states to those actions. So if we see somebody who bends down and helps a beggar out of the gutter and cleans them up or raises them up, you know, as it might be, then we would say, oh, that person is compassionate. That's the psychological state, the motivation. So when God raises, you know, somebody who's poor or lame or whatever out and lifts them up, then we'd say, oh, God is compassionate. But in reality, you can't really ascribe. That's just us projecting our own experience onto God. And so it's important for Maimonides that all we really have is not any direct knowledge or any intuited knowledge of God's properties or God's essence. All we have is actions. We interpret from those actions, but the way we do it is to project our own human consciousness or human experience onto that. And that's not a valid rational step, but it is a valid homiletic step if you're telling stories in the Bible about how to get people to act properly or to judge what's right or what's wrong.
I think another weird Aristotelian thing that's floating around here is realism with regard to properties, with regard to accidents. That is, like I was saying, that the fundamental ontology, the things you think that exist in the world, right? It's not just atoms or something according to Aristotle. It's substances which are fundamentally unified in some way, and then the properties that they have, the accidents. And, you know, we tend to think that a property is just a description. It's just the way that the mind gets a hold of something. And it's not necessarily referring to anything real. I could define a property right now that I could say, here's property X. And X means to the left of my computer mouse, but below this light bulb and above, you know, I could make some really complex bullshitty thing that happens to be true of my hand right now because of the position of it and say, oh, that's a property my hand has. If you think you can do that and that's a real property, then you are a nominalist about properties. In other words, you're saying they're just words. They're just descriptions. But Aristotle, you know, they're fundamentally in his ontology. So that's why it's important to Maimonides that if you're saying stuff about God, you're not just trying to get your mind at him. Actually, this ends up being what, when you say God is, you know, not unjust, that is something that's just getting your mind as much as we can at the notion of God. But if you actually were to say God is just, then you are positing a multiplicity. You're saying that God is that substance, but then has this attribute and that attribute and that attribute. Oh, God has at least fivefold there. God has five faces, and you're being an idolater right there.
It's interesting because it forces you to see the world in terms of abstract.
The abstract is concrete, actually, that what we think are properties that are abstract. Aristotle and Maimonides considers them actually as concrete, that they're real things.
Going back to the unity, I like to think of it in terms of a body. A body is made of many atoms, and we have all these cells and everything together. So it's one body. You could say, hey, there's Danny, he's one person. But really, I'm composed of many different things. I have a skeleton, I have organs, I have all these things, but I'm just one thing, correct?
According to my take, a nominalist take is that according to one level of description, you're one thing, and according to another level of description, you are many things.
Right.
That is all foreign to this historical period we're talking about.
None of that plays into this, you're saying.
Yeah, he's going to have to say that it is more literal. So according to Aristotle, for instance, in Maimonides here, the soul controls the body, and the soul is a unified thing that pushes the body around. Whereas we might say, what is the soul? If what you mean by soul is mind, well, isn't the mind, you know, a bunch of neurons in the brain firing and some different way of talking about, like, we wouldn't want to say for sure, oh, there's just this single thing. But even Aristotle, who didn't believe that a soul in the Christian sense of you die and then your soul is a ghost that floats away, he still thought that every organism, even a ladybug, even, you know, something moving in an orbit, like, if it has a principle of motion, then it has a soul. It has a unity. It is a unified thing, a real unified thing.
But couldn't you say that the soul is a piece of God, if nothing? I mean, like, isn't it all? I don't know. I keep going back to this idea with the unity. This is where I find it all very hard to understand.
I think it's supposed to be hard to understand.
Right, right.
That's the point. I'm right there with you.
So he does make a distinction in one of these chapters between intellect and the spirit. He's saying here the different ways to take care of the body, including, you know, if you have everything provided for comfort, mm-hmm. food, and shelter, that's how you take care of the physical part. But then he breaks down a spiritual part and an intellectual part. So there's really three parts, to my understanding, that he's talking about. So consciousness would be, he calls it, self-consciousness is wisdom, in quotes, wisdom. And this is in book three?
It's definitely book three, yeah.
Yeah. And he's talking about, it is impossible to imagine the creator created himself, but the creator has a consciousness of self, which is what we call wisdom.
Yep.
So, I mean, he is showing a difference between what is considered a soul and intellect. So he's not saying your soul lives in your brain. He's not saying your thoughts are your soul.
I'm trying to find where and whether it's different in my translation, what you're talking about with spirit. This is chapter 27 you're talking about.
I think so.
Or you're looking at your notes. You're not.
I'm really looking at notes here. I'm not in the book anymore. I just wrote down things that I thought were interesting when I was going through it.
Okay. I got chapter 27 up here. So just to put some context on what Danny's mentioning. In book three, we were talking about book one was the discussion we were talking about with God and the unity, which I think we'll still need to close that some stuff out on. Book three, there are some chapters dedicated to the law. So in chapter 27, he says, the general object of the law is twofold, the well-being of the soul and the well-being of the body. So there's a lot going on in this chapter because he's talking about the individual in the sense of the individual has to have a healthy body, meaning they have to get adequate rest,
remove all violence,
food, shelter, etc., in order to be able to cultivate the soul, which for Maimonides means cultivate knowledge of God, strive towards perfection. For him, it's an intellectual exercise, no doubt about it, but it ultimately is for the well-being of the soul. But he's also expanding on that here, and he goes back and forth between talking about, for example, this is a traditional move, the body of the state. Human beings can't provide food and shelter and satisfy all the needs of the body and simultaneously create the space for intellectual development and the cultivation of the well-being of the soul, except in a social group, because no one human being can provide for all of their needs and simultaneously do this cultivation. So this is really about the society and the state, as well as the individual in this particular passage.
I like the quote, man has a double perfection. What does that mean? I put that down.
That is the one of the body and the one of the soul. So that you could be in perfect physical health, that's a perfection to shoot for, but then you also have to get in perfect intellectual. And so I'm not seeing in here any distinction made between the spiritual and the intellectual like you were referring to.
He doesn't make a distinction, Mark, in terms of saying there's the intellectual and the spiritual, but he's talking about the well-being of the soul, which is ultimately the spiritual aspect, but it's to be achieved intellectually.
Right. He is referring to them in different ways. He's saying you can't perfect the soul without intellect, which does break them into two different things. And then he says you can't have the intellect without taking care of your body. If you're not taking care of your body physically, then you cannot achieve the things intellectually that will perfect you spiritually. That's how I saw it.
Okay, so Seth has to read an ad with us on making fun of him.
Well, Danny doesn't have to be involved with this.
But, I think he should have to.
I'll do it.
Okay.
What is the ad for? Please tell us, Seth, who is our sponsor for this time?
Yeah, who, Seth? Who's the sponsor, Seth?
The sponsor is Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
How fast? How easy? Tell us more.
Does God fast. Exist in the square of space?
He has no is space God there? And
does,
no shape.
Does God provide 24-hour support for Squarespace?
Now, if we were to say that God provided 24-hour support through live chat and email, either in New York City or in Dublin, we would, of course, be limiting God to a category of tech support.
Mm-hmm.
Which would not be the right thing to do.
But someone else does. Someone else provides that support and many useful tools for making your website quickly and easily with awesome design choices and templates and stuff.
Yeah, and that's really the key point, that what Squarespace gives you is a bunch of great templates, depending on what you want to accomplish. If you want to put your portfolio of pictures, or if you're a blogger, if you've got a store, simple and easy to use, drag and drop. You get all the support you need.
Every site is designed in the image of God. Isn't that right?
If you choose the God template.
If you choose the God template, then yes. And much like
it's,
God.
It's purely a negative template.
It just tells you all the things you can't put in it. It doesn't actually provide you. It's just a blank page.
People like that. A lot of white space is nice nowadays on a website.
Yes. Unlike God, the Squarespace design is responsive, and we can, of course, we can put attributive, we can attribute human qualities to the people that are involved. So, for a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter the offer code EXAMINED at checkout. A better web starts with your website.
Cool.
Thanks, Seth. Yeah. Let's go back to the conversation. You know, this actually ties very much back to what we were talking about in the first book about the difference between a necessary property and a contingent property, right? An accident and a necessary property is that a necessary property would have to be part of the definition of the thing. And so for people, he says, people are entirely defined by this concept Aristotle came up with of rational animal. And so those are the two components. That's all you need. And so these two perfections correspond to those two different parts of us exactly, that you've got the perfection of the body, which is any kind of animal could have that kind of perfection, and the perfection of the soul, which is exerting our rationality to its natural state of perfection, which is to know God, right? To know God in the right way. That's the whole point of using your rationality for this tradition.
But doesn't that still create a distinction between the soul and your rationality? The rationality is not the soul. It's a tool that you can utilize to try and perfect your soul. It isn't one and the same.
Well, we're going to have to go back and read some Aristotle eventually here on this to get clear on here. So every kind of organism has a natural sort of pointer. It has what he calls a telos. It's a teleology. So even a material object, its telos is to go down. Its gravity is its telos. That's the nature of a rock, of anything made of earth, that it wants to go down. And it's the same with the other elements. Fire wants to go up and water wants to swish around. I don't remember exactly how it works. But for any animal, its telos is to, you know, what we would call instinct, is to become the most full and awesome version of the thing that it can be. So the telos of a mosquito is extremely simple. Get in there and bite you and reproduce, and that's it.
I hate the telos of mosquitoes. I've always said.
And so our telos as rational animals is, well, we have that animal part of us. We have a nutritive nature, just like plants. Plants don't run around and look for food, but they still have like a way of being healthy. And so all the animals have that in common with plants, but then they have this animal part on top of it that we have. But then humans have this extra part, the rational part. And so rationality is really a description of the telos. You're right. It's not that the soul is the rationality. The soul is Danny. That's you. Danny is equivalent to the soul. You are not your body, actually. Your body is your tool.
Man.
But you are your soul, according to this Aristotelian version, right?
Yeah.
And your telos would be, you know, rationality pointing toward correct knowledge of God. Anybody schooled in Freud or anything like that would not think that that's overall what your intellect is striving to do. But according to these guys, yeah, that's what the mind is all about.
Oh, look, it's almost time for telos.
Well, let's turn that back then. We got this stuff about definition of why that doesn't work for God. So he's saying God doesn't have these accidents, right? He doesn't have properties, but he also doesn't have essential attributes, because what the essential attributes are just the definition, right? So as a person, my essential attributes are animality and rationality, and that's it. Everything else, like what city I was born in, that I have this body as opposed to, you know, these cells opposed to other cells, those are all accidents, really. They're kind of foreign to my existence as a representative of the human race.
Yeah,
right?
My body is an accident that came from a lot of pizza.
And actually, that's a good, what our essential attributes are, our definition is always something actually that we have in common with other things. What is essential to a person is the same thing for all people, according to this view. So you can see then why you wouldn't want to have that for God, because there are not multiple gods. So you can't say God is the greatest being, because that sort of defines a category of being. Just giving it a category at all, giving it a definition at all, creates a class term. And you're saying God is one member, maybe the only member, but he's still a member of this class term. And that's to lessen God in some way, that you're saying, oh, he's beneath the conceptual term of even calling it, you know, the one true God. There's something wrong with any name that you could give him.
Yeah. Or any name, any attribute, any classification. then you're subordinating God to some sort of, if you're saying that this is the essential characteristic. You know, I was thinking about how he could say in the first part that the one thing about God is that he's a single unity, but in reality, he clarifies that later and says, actually, you don't say that God is a single substance or a unitary substance. You just say that God is not a plurality.
Right. That
that's the negative way of characterizing the same thing.
He was so negative. Why was he so negative about everything? Maybe it's because he was kicked out of two countries.
I guess that's what I always thought when I heard negative theology.
He's the Debbie Downer of rabbis.
Actually, three right. countries. I understand. I think he went to Israel for a minute there, and his caravan got held up, and they decided to turn around and go back to Egypt. Isn't that something, after all that effort that the Jews spent getting out of Egypt to go back? It makes you wonder a little bit about Maimonides' intellect. That's the only hole in all of this. Why go back to Egypt? My grandpa Cyril, may he rest in peace, used to say, the Jews don't belong in Egypt. We'll not go back to Egypt. And my mom and dad went on a trip to Egypt. He goes, don't go back there. It takes plagues to get out of there, you know?
Well, this whole Mediterranean region at the time was predominantly Arab, right? Islam just expanded. You know, there's a lot of push in the doctrine to expand your political lands that would be controlled by this. And that actually, for the most part, they allowed other religions, you know, other biblical religions to coexist as minority and kind of lesser status, but unpersecuted. And so it was actually kind of an exception. It was a kind of a revolutionary weird thing for this one group to come to power in Spain, which was already Islamically controlled, and say, no, actually everybody has to convert or get out of here. That was way more obnoxious than the other Arabs in that part of the world were being at the time.
Right. My rabbi growing up, may he rest in peace, came from Casablanca, and he told us, he used to tell us in his sermons, that the Arabs were fine with having Jews live there as long as they knew their place as second-class citizens. He used to say that that's probably the only way to achieve peace with Jews and Arabs living together, is if they lived as second-class citizens in the Arab world. That's the only way. And for many years, like you're talking about, that's how it went. And my rabbi told us stories about, you know, just when he was a kid and you'd be walking down the block, if there were some Muslims walking towards him on the block, he'd have to get off the sidewalk and onto the street and wait and let them pass. And there were things like that that would show respect to them as the upperclassmen, which is why they were allowed to live peacefully as Jews in Morocco. So not a lot has changed. I mean, that's pretty current times.
I guess I don't know quite enough about the history to say whether it doesn't seem, from what I read here, that at least where he ended up in Egypt, that Maimonides had anything like that kind of persecution or, you know, was living under that cloud.
Well, Maimonides was, I think he came from Cordova, Spain.
Right. That's right. His family fled there because of the persecution, yes. And then in the next place in, right, he was also, maybe they even lived as pretend Muslims for a while. That's a point of scholarly debate. Mm-hmm. And then, but where he ended up, he was out of the closet.
But even as a physician to the ruler in Egypt, I forget what you call him.
The vizier of Saladin, yeah.
Even then, he was, from my understanding, they tried to kill him on more than one occasion, and they tried to frame him, make it look like he was trying to kill the guy he was. And it's interesting, you know, a lot of the medicine that they practiced back then is, you know, completely ancient and antiquated and ridiculous to us now. But I was talking to a friend of mine who's a very well-respected Jewish physician and who also studied some of Maimonides' medical journals that are available, and said a lot of this stuff is still practiced today, which is unbelievable to him, that some of his techniques are still in use. So,
yeah, we should emphasize that he was a medical guy. He had a lot of respect for the science of that. Like, as you were saying, that this health of the body is a prerequisite for this health of the soul, for correct beliefs about God and things, correct behavior. So that's really the purpose of a lot of the law, is to just put people in a position where they're going to have good habits and be at peace, and so be able to thrive intellectually.
It actually says in the intro to the Guide for the Perplexed, it says, before I get into anything, hygiene, 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 people. I can't stress this enough. Floss.
Cleanliness is next to godliness, but is in no way an essential or accidental attribute.
And cleanliness is one with godliness, because there's the unity of it all.
I want to bring it back for a second. I think we're almost to the end of the book one stuff. Let's just wrap up a couple more points. So he goes through, you know, why God can't have contingent or accidental properties. Why he doesn't have properties, strictly speaking. We talked about that. Because he's unity. That would create a multiplicity. Well, why can't he have necessary properties? Why can't he say that, you know, God is necessarily good? He's necessarily all powerful. Well, necessary is just about saying what the definition of God is. We can't know the definition of God. The definition of God is so ungraspable by us that we can't say any of those things. And if you want to say any of those things, again, you have to interpret them in terms of actions. So if you want to say God is just, you have to be just referring to things about the world that you've, you know, looked
perceive
at. Okay,
as just.
Yeah, tragedies happen, but
right.
Overall, the things behave in a law-like way. If you do floss, you can keep your teeth from falling out more or less. Maybe you'll get punched, but there are ways of acting to lessen the likelihood that you'll get punched. Things in society that you can do to even things out. In that sense, the world is just. We're sort of just being metaphorical if we then say God is just based on that. And by the same token, you might think that there are all these different properties that God has. Well, his strength, his justice, his... But what we're really talking about is just different aspects of the world. You know, the fact that there are giant floods. So that seems like God's strength must be causing that. Whereas what I was talking about before is God's justice or his sense of order. But really, those could just be caused by one thing. And he gives the analogy, again, back to people. That people could do all this stuff. They could write manuscripts. They could create architecture. They could do engineering. And it's not because we have all these different faculties. It's just because we have the faculty of rationality. And rationality can create all those different things. And so by analogy, God is a unitary substance, only really has one essence that we can't even say anything about. One property that, you know, if he has any property, existence, right? Things you would want to attribute as properties. Well, certainly he exists. Certainly he's unified. Well, even that, you're just really actually referring to his essence itself.
Essentially.
Yeah. Insofar as you can refer to this. Okay. So anyway, we have no accidental properties, no necessary or essential properties. Can he be related to us or to anything? And that's the tricky one. He says, well, strictly speaking, no, because a relation points out a similarity, right? If I say this book is to the left of this computer, then I'm saying, well, they're both physical objects existing in time and space, and one is contiguous to the other. If you say this one is a darker than, well, you're saying they both have colors, but God has no properties in common since he has no properties with anything. So strictly speaking, he can't be in relation to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really weird because that sounds like, well, didn't God create the world? Isn't
right,
that a relation?
You can't.
You know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. They talk about that a little bit.
He would say, you know, that's being expressed in language we can understand, but whatever it is that God does, it's not anything like what we would do. Somehow it's a non-relational.
But he does say that man can have a relationship with God, Seth. There is some of that in there. He says it is possible for man and God to have a relationship. And if man and God have a relationship, that means his creations have a relationship with him. So I thought that was a little bit of a contradiction.
Yeah, right. Because it sounds like if you say no relations, then certainly there's no personal God. Right? That's the whole point of a personal God is it is a relationship with people, with the Jews, with you. So he says, actually, well, strictly speaking, there's no relation, but talking about relationships between God and everything else is less erroneous, is not actual idolatry in the way that imputing a property, essential or otherwise, to him would be.
It's a relationship, but you can't break up. There's no breaking up because it's not really a relationship.
And
is it a
relationship?
I don't think
it gets any clearer than that. Seth, did you see anything that made this whole relation business clearer than what I just said?
No. I mean, we can probably read the whole...
I think God really figured it out in a way that we can never figure out the answer to, is this a relationship? Am I in a relationship?
When in doubt, read it.
Okay. He is not... This is picking up the tail end of what Mark was saying. He's not composed of an element that apprehends, another that doesn't apprehend. He is not like man, who is a combination of conscious soul and unconscious body. Therefore, by wisdom, we mean the faculty of self-consciousness. Oh, here's that point you were talking about earlier, Danny. Wisdom and life are one and the same thing. There is also no doubt that power and will do not exist in God in reference to himself, for he cannot have power or will as regards himself. We cannot imagine such a thing. They take these attributes as different relations between God and his creatures, signifying that he has power in creating things, will in giving things existence as he desires, and wisdom in knowing what he created. Consequently, these attributes do not refer to the essence of God, but express relations between him and his creatures. All he's saying here is, when you use the language that suggests that God has power or will or wisdom, what you're really talking about is his actions, specifically the action of creation, the action of generating things, and the way in which we speak about God knowing and interacting, at least, or being aware of his creation.
And his cheat word is, so it doesn't sound like him creating things is an is like a relation action, I believe, is emanation, which he takes from Plotinus and other guys like that. That it's not that he has to whip up his recipe and make the universe. It's that the universe emanates from
I don't know how that happened. That's one of the great mysteries that's not in the six chapters that we read. But he does say, just two sentences later, there is no difference whether these various attributes refer to his actions or to relations between him and his works. In fact, these relations, as we have also shown, exist only in the thoughts of men.
So there's the difference, right? Between Aristotle's view of properties is a realist view, that properties are actually things. I mean, they're not things because then they would be substances, but they are a part of the ontology. They are things that things have, you might say, right? They're real in a way, but relations are just something that the mind imposes here. That's why it's okay to say that God is related in certain ways to his creation, because that's just the mind trying to get a hold of this matter. It's not actually something in the world, like to the left of, which you're actually, if you say this is to the left of that, you're, well, it's not that to the left of is a real thing that you could then isolate, but you're referring to a schema of space. And so, yes, we can understand space in a way independent of understanding any particular items in space, right? So it's real in that sense.
It's still perspectival in that I could walk around to the other side and it would be to the right of, right?
Well, to the north of then. What? They're non-perspectival, at least according to this. They don't have the earth spinning around and stuff. So yes, there are spatial relations that are non-perspectival. Should we talk about space and time for a minute? Is this the time, or did we?
We don't have the space, but we have the time.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about space and time.
Pick one.
Well, we'll get to it in the context of creation.
Well, space, time, and numbers, I guess, would all be constructs of man within the universe, right? And if the universe, because this goes back to, I was thinking about that book by, you know, he's in a wheelchair, he's talks through the
keyboard. Stephen Hawking?
Yes.
Summarizing Maimonides?
Yeah, no. But he had a book, Stephen Hawking put a book out about disproving God's
also
existence.
Also known as a Rambam.
Stephen Hawking had this book about disproving God. And he said that there was no time for God to have existed in the universe, but if the universe is a construct separate to God and time is a construct of man,
yes,
then that argument to me wouldn't prove anything, right?
Well, I don't think we have to say that time is a construct of man. I think we could still say that time is real, but it is part of the real universe. So this is, again, Aristotle's view that motion is a real property. It's an accident that things have. Mm-hmm. And then time, according to this, and this is never explained anymore, and we can't really even ferret into why this might be, but is actually a property of motion, you know, like moving quickly, moving slowly, moving. So he thinks, you know, moving at 3 o'clock is actually a property that a property itself, the movement, has. So it is not created by the human mind. It is real, mm-hmm. but it's hard for us to get a hold of because it's an adverb, essentially. It's a property of a property. And that, he thinks, is why people have been, Maimonides thinks, why people have been so confused about what time might be. And maybe time doesn't even really exist. Maybe it's just, right, maybe it's all in our heads.
And time wouldn't
exist
for God,
right?
No,
it's actually
right?
real, but it's, right, it's not something that is applicable to God. It's applicable to the creation. Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty smooth transition to the little bit of book two that we read, which was on the eternity of the world. And you might think that the world has always existed. And in fact, this is what Aristotle thought. And this is why it's a big deal, because almost everywhere else in this book, Maimonides is just saying, yeah, Aristotle was right, and actually he can be fit right with the Torah, and they all work together great. But here's a place where the Torah, the Bible says that, yeah, there was nothing, and then God created everything. So there's an actual starting point. Now, if you want to say there was a time that God existed before creation, you're using the word time metaphorically, allegorically. It's something like time, but no, because time, like you said, is part of the creation, part of what he came up with. So there's nothing you could say, right, like cosmologically, there's nothing that science has relevant to say about this notion other than why do we need to posit a creator like that, you know, but that's getting into this, you know, philosophy of science stuff. There's nothing, there's no positive proof against other than you might argue that this notion of God simply doesn't make sense. that's, mm-hmm. but the, you know, why there couldn't have been a creator that is nothing like us that we can't say anything about existing outside of time. There's nothing that could say yay or nay in modern science about that.
Your modern science pish posh. And that's a quote from Dracula Dead and Loving It. What does your modern science say about that, Van Helsing?
As pish quoted posh. By all the big name philosophers now.
Yeah, they all quote Mel Brooks. Somewhere in Maimonides, there's a Mel Brooks line.
So anyway, as far as this eternity stuff, for various Aristotelian reasons that we're not going to go into, Aristotle thought that the universe must have always existed. And you might think of it just in terms of, well, what would have made God decide at some particular time to create everything?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is sort of the same thing again that was going back into that everything that has, the entire world must be just a necessary outpouring of God's nature. Like, because God is just not whimsical. He doesn't just think about things and then make his mind to do this and then think about things again and do this. Like, that is way too anthropomorphic. So to avoid that, Aristotle and folks like him wanted to just say, okay, there's just the universe has always existed. God is the one that is the prime mover. He causes all the motion. But in terms of the existence of everything, he didn't. You know, Aristotle's actually giving a different story. Anyway, so in this chapter 13, book 2, he gives this story and says, look, there are three different accounts of the beginning of the world. One is the biblical one. Mm-hmm. Everything was created out of nothing. One is the Aristotelian one, which is everything has always existed. And then he gives a third one, which is he attributes to Plato, which is that, well, there was a creation, but it was a transformation. That you can't just ever have just creation out of nothing. You must have had, like, you know, the raw stuff that was out there. And then God took the raw stuff and he smashed it and molded it and made it into something. And that's the world.
Which would mean that God couldn't create the raw stuff? Is that?
Right. It has to. Okay. So here's the thing. Maimonides is committed to saying that the biblical one, the Torah one, is the correct one. Not just because that's what it says in Genesis. Because you could interpret Genesis in, you know, as at least the Plato version. He thinks is not terrible. And he even says, like, all other things being equal, Aristotle's pretty convincing. He gives a whole really, really long chapter of all these Aristotelian arguments why the world has to be eternal. And said, well, I would go with Aristotle. But really, even Aristotle recognized that he hadn't made a slam dunk case, that he hadn't actually proved it in the way that he proved God exists by the prime mover argument. Mm. By all these arguments about the eternity, he still, you know, by various things you could see in the text, you could see that he left it open to interpretation. So here's me, Maimonides, coming in, and I'm going to say that the unity of God means that these other stories have to be wrong, right? Because there can only be one being, God, that has existed for all eternity. If there was something else at the beginning with him before creation, then that's polytheism. Right. Or at least that's like positing a multiplicity in God. There's God and his attributes, or God and his built-in, you know, there's some versions of Christianity that interpret the we talk in Genesis not as the royal we, God talking about, you know, we, when he's really just meaning himself, but that that actually was right at the very beginning, was Jesus or the Holy Ghost or something was right there with him. And this is all way out of bounds for Maimonides. He got it. That just violates unity. You're not even a monotheist at all.
Right.
Speaking of which, it's suggested in what we read, but not, I don't think, super explicitly spelled out, but is the reason he's doing all this work about unity because he thinks that's the differentiation between the monotheistic God and polytheism? Like, why is it so important for him to insist on and prove the unity? Is it just because
that there are so many holdovers from polytheism in, you know, early biblical and enough of the history. You guys probably know more than this. But isn't it kind of the idea is that when the Israelites were running around in the first place and with Moses and it created this idea that it really was our God is the best God. You know, thou shalt not worship other gods before me. That's not saying there is no other God, so just worship me. It's saying, I'm the Lord, and I kick all those other little stupid gods' asses that you allegedly worship. And so, you know, basically this was a gradual thing, you know, just like even in ancient Greece and through Rome, you know, when those old-time religions, it started out with a very old-time polytheism and all the gods are running around being dicks to each other. But then they're talking about Zeus as being the creator, and that if you're really religious, then you don't believe all this crap about different gods seducing women and killing each other, that you believe in the central, you know. So it's throughout history and all this different area, at least around the Mediterranean, you have this movement toward bona fide monotheism. And this is just another step in that.
Yeah. You mentioned that it's important for him to bring this out because there's a sense in which he's trying to say, for the true seeker of perfection, for the person who really wants to understand God, you have to understand that having any conception of God, any positive conception of God, is a form of idolatry. And idolatry is definitely a big no-no. Like, it's one of the top no-nos.
Yep.
But one of the things that this brought to me, and I'll say this and Danny will know what I'm talking about, is there's a Hebrew prayer called the Shema, or Shema, which says, "Hear Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one." And it might be the most common prayer. It's certainly said as frequently, I think, as just about any other.
Right.
I don't think I ever gave any sort of metaphysical thought to what the significance of that was, but tying it into this, I think, you know, I do see that it's basically the constant reaffirmation of the primacy of the monotheistic God over, even though there's no such thing as polytheism anymore. And even in the 12th century, Islam was a monotheistic religion and Christianity is a Christianity is debatable, but Islam is definitely a monotheistic religion.
According to Judaism, Christianity is idolatry, whereas Islam is not.
One little historical point. So the very guys that were persecuting, you know, that chased Maimonides out of Spain, this belief in that God does not have a body and is unified, that was something they believed too. Maimonides is getting this from the Arabic philosophers, including those bastards that were persecuting him.
Well, there are definitely a lot of similarities. I mean, to the extent of, for example, Jews do not have any pictorial representations of God. Same way that it's forbidden in Islam. I don't know, it's forbidden, I guess, in scare quotes in Judaism, but it's just not a thing. There's not a lot of religious-inspired pictorial art. There are other forms of creative expression, but, you know, it took the Christians to find a way to actually put a sculpture together of Moses, right?
Again, yeah, it's all in the semantics. The differences between Judaism and Islam, it's very, I think it's the closeness and the similarity is what causes so much conflict. It's almost a sibling rivalry. Like, if you feel like your sibling is too much like you, you start wanting your own identity and it starts making you fight as kids. You're like,
it's actually,
he stole my favorite color. You know, you're like, that's me. You can't be. And I think that's why Jews and Muslims have been fighting for so long, is just because it's too similar almost, you know, it's just little semantics that make it.
It's who's the greatest prophet.
Yeah,
Moses or Muhammad. It's not actually really about God.
Yeah, we all the pigs are protected under both religions, you know.
Well, so just to bring it back to the text, the position that, you know, the world is created and not eternal was also argued by his Muslim predecessors, Al-Farabi. I don't remember the names of the ones in particular he's talking about, but but he thinks their arguments are crap. So there's a big section of this book that goes through these Muslim intellectuals that, you know, were really the dominant. They're the ones who translated, you know, Maimonides is writing in Arabic and he read Aristotle in Arabic. He didn't read the Greek. So he's entirely participating in this, you know, very much Aristotelian tradition that was entirely Islamic. In the same way, he's taken those immediate predecessors, some of them, you know, Averroes, I guess, is the last famous Muslim philosopher, was alive at the same time as Maimonides. And it looked like Maimonides didn't discover him until pretty late in life, but he had read him by the time he wrote this work. And so he's responding to those guys in very much the same, like you're saying, in the kind of the sibling rivalry way. He's saying, well, you guys were right in what you were arguing for, mm-hmm. but your arguments were crap. And if you believe a true thing based on crap arguments, that's just going to undermine your belief in the thing at all. Like that's almost as bad as believing the wrong thing.
These were the original rap battles too, I think, you know?
He goes on so much at length at how Aristotle's arguments for the eternity, there's actually a big scholarly dispute I was reading about, like, what Maimonides' real view is. And this kind of goes back to, you know, what Seth was talking about, why he wrote this book and the, you know, the fact that this was esoteric teaching that just happened to be, you know, he was kind of breaking the rules to write this stuff down that's really supposed to be just for the elite. Because once you write it down, anybody can read it. Although he did write it in Arabic, so not all Jews could read this at the time. Still.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I wonder who spoke what kind of languages. I would imagine there's also speaking versus reading, but that's a whole nother thing. To bring it back to the text and talking about crap arguments versus good arguments and all this, right? By the way, this online edition, Mark, the chapters are in Roman numerals. I, for the life of me, did not know that L was 50, and I'm still looking at it, and I'm having trouble understanding it. I believe this is chapter 59. He says, the following question might perhaps be asked. Since there is no possibility of attaining a knowledge of the true essence of God, and since it has also been proved that the only thing man can apprehend of him is the fact that he exists and that all positive attributes are inadmissible, what's the difference among those who have obtained a knowledge of God? Must not the knowledge obtained by Moses, blah, 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 be the same as any one of the lowest class of philosophers, since there can be no addition, right? So it's basically like, if you can't know anything, what would differentiate somebody who knows nothing but doesn't know they don't know anything and somebody who's spent a lifetime learning that they don't know anything? Further on in the chapter, he basically says, listen, if you've gone through all the arguments and you've looked at all the evidence and you've come to a clear understanding of why such and such a negative attribute, why God truly cannot be corporeal.
You have a clear understanding of the fact that you can't understand, in other words.
This.
Well, and the specific things you can't understand.
About very specific things, yeah. Right. Not just in general. Like, this isn't a Socratic deal. It's like, okay, I have a really good idea about why God can't be corporeal, but I'm totally lost on the whole eternity of the world / creation / time thing. You're in a better place than somebody who says, like, well, I've been told that he's not corporeal, but I don't even understand that. I just, you know, it's the intellectual activity of trying to understand all of these negative truths or negative facts that is, in fact, differentiates you or makes you a, you know, quote unquote, man of knowledge, which is a very interesting way of classifying the teleology of the true student.
Well, and he gives that analogy of the ship, that even if I didn't tell you what a ship was, I could just say, well, it's not a rock, and you know, it's not on land, and I could just give you more and more stuff, and you'd kind of get closer and closer, even though you don't really know what a ship is, but you'd get a better and better idea.
He uses a funny example. He says, if I tell you there's a thing in a room, and you don't, like, to tell two people, and one person just knows there's a thing, but they don't know what it is, but I tell you, guess what? It's not a plant or a mineral. Like, you're in a better position than the person who doesn't know at least that it's not a plant or a mineral.
So he's saying that somebody who's a student is going to say, hey, look, I don't know much clearer than you don't know. I have a much deeper understanding of not knowing. Look, you don't know, but you don't know on the level that I don't know, okay?
Well, was that what your experience was like when you were at yeshiva?
No, I mean, a lot of what we studied in yeshiva was Gemara, which is a lot of the arguments back and forth on different halachas, which are the different commandments and how they're supposed to be interpreted and applied. You know, there's these different rabbis that would argue over what exactly it means and how you're supposed to do it. It was good brain exercise for sure. I thought it was always pretty fascinating. And then I always like the backstories on these rabbis, and, you know, some of them have a good mythology to them. One rabbi became the head of the Sanhedrin, which was like the high court. And I think he was a teenager, but he was the brightest of all the rabbis. And they were concerned about, even though he was the most qualified, but because of his young age, nobody would respect him. So there was a miracle that occurred overnight, and he woke up with a long white beard. There's some pretty cool stories there. I mean, I'm a storyteller, and I love stories. So I really definitely would geek out on that stuff. And I still do, you know.
Did any of it have to do with these issues of ontology, of metaphysics, or was it all about,
it was more,
you know,
about
details of the law?
More
of
about
what you
law.
Should do.
It was about Jewish law and practice. For instance, like if you find some money on the floor,
yeah.
What are the simanim, which are the signs that are on it? Is it in a band? Is it in a rubber band? Can it be identifiable as somebody's band? Did you find it in a public domain or in a private domain? What time of day was it? Where were you an hour before? What were you eating? Who were you with? But there was some kind of an interrogation to it. So it's there were all these questions of, can you keep the money in this situation? And it wasn't just money. I don't want to make it into a Jewish stereotype, you know, but can I have the money? Come on.
I always hear thorns on the road. That's no, the example not, that I always hear about.
It's not just money. There's often stuff in there about pastrami and lox.
Well, I don't hear thorns as a Jewish stereotype. And that's the example I always hear about the practical, about the Talmudic going through. If you throw the thorns on the road and somebody steps on them, you know, are you liable? Do you have to pay damages, basically? Like all this very legalistic stuff and commentaries on commentaries about that. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it's surprising to me. And this, what I was listening to these lectures by Leo Strauss, who was kind of a transformative guy in the 60s in terms of Maimonides scholarship, that he was one of the guys that really said, no. He's not just a guy saying what reason tells you. He's a Jew. He's starting with the Jew. He's not your philosopher, Christian medieval scholars. He's our guy because he starts with the truth of Jewish law. And how do we sort of make sense out of that rather than some other way? Anyway,
are we talking about Neil Strauss, who wrote the Motley Crue book? Same guy?
I'm sure that is not the same guy.
Okay.
But according to Strauss, theology is not even a term that Jews use. That's a Christian term. So that's what we normally, if we talk about, like, well, how many angels dance on the head of a pin? Or, you know, what is the exact relationship between God and Christ? Is Christ God? All that stuff's theology. That's pretty foreign to most of Jewish intellectual thought. And it seems like maybe you can see that reflected in the way Maimonides treats it. Or maybe it's a result of the way Maimonides treats it because this book was so freaking influential. Mm. And everything else that Maimonides wrote was so freaking influential in the Jewish tradition. On the one hand, when you're talking about these, you know, what we call theological matters, you get this, what is his view really? Does he agree with Aristotle? It's not even really clear. He, from what I hear and other things Strauss said, it's very much like those Buddhist or Taoist texts where it's like sometimes he contradicts himself, because really what you say in this kind of teaching is entirely a matter of like what the student is ready for.
Right.
And this whole thing, right? This is addressed to a student, a former student of his. This, you know, it was meant to obviously to be read by more people, but, you know, he's focused first on about the specific gaps in knowledge and stuff that this former student of his had. And so, you know, you kind of tailor from section to section in the book where you think the audience is at or how, what they're ready for. And, you know, it's the same thing, because this is supposed to be, part of it is the secret knowledge, this esoteric knowledge. And part of it is supposed to be this stuff like God is not a body that everybody, every Jew is supposed to freaking believe. It's supposed to know. It's supposed to understand. So he has these two different audiences, and this leads to a very disorganized in some ways book. On the other hand, when you're talking about practical matters of what the law is, you know, compare this with the Mishra Torah, that the whole point of that is to be very straightforward and detailed and not dick around about here are all the arguments here to and from, and some of these are definitive and some of them are not. Some of these, you know, lots of places in here he says like, well, this is the best I can do in terms of this argument, but maybe somebody else has a better argument, or... You know, he's pretty modest. We're supposed to realize that we know nothing is ultimately what we come down for on this theoretical stuff. But that's so different from our knowledge of the law, which is just by faith, we buy the law and we need to just understand it.
I think right? The book really accomplishes that. I mean, it's such a dense read and it requires so much focus. And by the end of it, you really do feel like you know a lot less than when you started reading it. It's one of those rare books that makes you feel less informed by the end of it.
But I wanted to use that as a way to turn back to just, you know, as a last theme to talk about for a few minutes, those book three chapters that we're talking about the law, that he's saying, you know, what's the purpose of the law? You were saying before, it's, you know, it's to promote bodily perfection and perfection of the mind. So we've got the picture of what he considers the purpose of the law to be. But the way that these sections end, he says, well, what about the laws that look like they're bullshit? You know, you got to kill the calf by hacking it in the back of the neck as opposed to the front of the neck. And so he like says, well, some of the other commentators will say, well, if you dig deep enough, there's an obvious real purpose to this. And he says, like, those explanations are just beyond belief. Like, they're necessarily ad hoc and a pure apologetics. At the same time, he doesn't like the people who say, well, clearly this is arbitrary bullshit. And the only point is for us to prove that we are obedient to the law. It's just to test us, to make us be very picky about the way we do things, to make us conscious of how we behave. And that's the whole point. The exact details are, yeah, we need to obey it, but like it could have been something else.
The reason he puts it out there is around the question of, do all of these 613 commandments that there are in the Bible, do they all have a purpose? So some of them you say are obvious, right? Like, okay, floss your teeth, right? We get that one. We know why we want to floss.
Don't kill.
But why do we have to sacrifice 7 ewes instead of 9? Or why are we doing ewes instead of rams or whatever? And he says, if we say that there's no purpose, you're basically saying that God does things whimsically or without reason, that that's not cool. But at the same time, we can't divine, so to speak, what those reasons are. So you can say, well, it's just a test to see how obedient you can be. It's the practical, recurring, and societally accepted manifestation of Abraham and Isaac.
Apparently, these commandments are not related to the welfare of the soul, as they do not communicate a belief, or to the welfare of the body, as they do not communicate rules useful for governance of the city or for governance of the household. Such as, for instance, the prohibitions on the mingling, meat and milk, etc.
Perplexing.
So this is almost how he ends the chapter. This is near the end of chapter 28. However, you will hear my explanation for all of them and my exposition of the correct and demonstrated causes for them all, with the sole exception, as I've mentioned to you, of the details and particular commandments. I shall explain that all these and others of the same kind are indubitably related to one of the 3 notions referred to, either the welfare or belief, or the welfare of the conditions of a city, which is achieved through 2 things, abolition of reciprocal wrongdoing and the acquisition of excellent characters. Apparently, the part that we didn't read after this is actually, after he said how ridiculous it is that some people try to justify all this stuff, he's going to give his own form of justification that he thinks works better. And I'm glad we didn't have to sift through that.
Did you get a chance to look at the prophecy stuff at all?
Tell us. So this was a section in book 2 that I had originally put in our stuff to read. I got just far enough to see that, yes, he had opinions that some prophets are legitimate and some are not. And part of what makes them legitimate is they're really smart. You know, like we've said, that reason makes you closer to God. So in fact, you can't just be like an idiot that is given a gift of prophecy. Like, you actually have to be a scholar to be a prophet.
And they say to kill the prophet, a false prophet needs to be killed. And I was thinking about that one for a little bit. And I have to say, I agree. Because think about how damaging a false prophet can be. This really would make people stop before they want to be a false prophet. Because if you think, yeah, what the hell, let me be a false prophet, get a bunch of people behind me and see what I can do by claiming God told me to do this. Well, what's to stop you? And you say, oh, well, if you're a false prophet and you're found out, you might get killed. Well, that's a good way, you know. You got to kill the false prophet. There's nothing more dangerous than a false prophet.
So I didn't read enough of this section to see what his opinion was, but he seemed to think there was a way to tell.
He said there were a
whether
bunch
someone
of different
was a false
things.
Prophet or not. In fact, if somebody's wise enough, it's not that God would have to act to put prophecy in his head. God would have to actually act to prevent prophecy from going in the head of someone who is the correct sort of wisdom, which you could presumably recognize. Right. So yeah, he seemed to think it was a lot easier to recognize a false prophet from a true one than anybody would think at this point.
Yeah, and it would definitely discourage anybody who's on the verge of, like, I think I'm a prophet. I mean, it's like, well, you know what? If I'm not 100% sure, I'm not even going public with this information because I could wind up dead. You got to be pretty damn sure you're a prophet. You better.
Surely there's a comedian that has been called some comedians are not just modern day philosophers, but they're the prophets of today. I get a similar feeling when somebody is like doing observational humor, but that I don't agree with those observations.
False prophecy. You
know? Then you're trying to get at something. You're trying to say what all of us want to say, but I don't want to say that at all. That is that's
forced,
bullshit.
A forced reference might be false prophecy for me. Somebody trying
so
to.
So kill them all. Kill all those comedians.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's one of those other things that Strauss brought up about reading this is if the whole point, a lot of what he's trying to put forth is that, you can't just read a text at face value. Then how the frick are we supposed to read this text? Are we supposed to read this text at face value? And Strauss at least thought, after studying this way more than I have, that no, that there's a lot of weird stuff in here. And you kind of have to interpretations on interpretations.
You need a guide for the
I'm sure there's one something called that. Exactly.
I love the name Guide for the Perplexed. And if they weren't perplexed before they read it, well, they sure were afterwards.
Right. You're perplexed because you're a believer in the science of the day, but you're also an observant religious person, and you're perplexed as to how these things could fit together. That's
been
the
there.
Perplexity.
I've been perplexed. I'm often perplexed.
And did this clear it up for you?
Oh, no. The only thing that really works is
Just getting stoned?
Oil of Olay. That's very good if you have a bad complexion. I'm out of it, man. Too much Rambam.
All right, man. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And thanks. I have to thank Seth for showing up because two out of our four regulars did not show up for this. Although at least Dylan's was planned. Wes just contacted us at the last minute. He had a bad sunburn. He couldn't come today.
Yes. Thank you, Seth.
False prophet.
Oh, I wanted to mention briefly, I never got to at the top, that my show is me and a different comedian every week. And we try to make our way through just a little bit of information on different philosophers. I try to find a tie-in. Alex Vasella picks the philosophers and picks somebody who has something in common with the guest. We talked very little about Maimonides when I talked to Carl Reiner.
The great, the legendary Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
Who cares? If you get Carl Reiner in there, you know, the fact that you read him a quote about Maimonides and he was just like, well, I'm an atheist, and then went on and on about his atheist.
Right.
Like, that's fine. He can say what the hell he wants.
It was entertaining either way, right?
So here's a PEL first. Let's play a clip.
I have three quotes here from Maimonides. You prefer I read them?
Yeah.
Do not consider it proof just because it is written in books, for a liar who will deceive with his tongue will not hesitate to do the same with his pen. So he's saying another
word. Oh, yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And today, Maimonides would have to say about television. And as soon as you read that, I'm seeing the Fox Network.
Yeah.
They come up with things and they tell you they're true and they're not.
Sure, they can present the same idea in different mediums, and you'll believe it more or less based on how you see it.
So Maimonides would be very, very, very active today if he were on television.
I think if he was around now, you'd probably go see him, if only for the medical. He was a doctor as well.
I know, Rambam. I love that name, Rambam.
I told Kylie I'd love to name a kid Rambam. It's a good, strong name.
It's giving him a big responsibility.
And then Mark Maron, we talked about Spinoza a little bit. So it gives you a taste, and it's a mixture of comedy and philosophy of the comics and the philosophy of the philosopher, and then just rants and tangents. So it's called Modern Day Philosophers Podcast. That's what it is. I'm a fan of you guys. I love what you do. What I do is more goofing around. I hope that some of your listeners will check out what I do, but I hope they won't be disappointed if they feel that it's not heavy enough on the philosophy. What I would tell people is go into it for the comedy, and you might wind up with some philosophy, too.
Well, you at least get to hear often what these guys think, you know, what their religious views are, what their views about psychics or whatever they think philosophy is.
Right. I try to not focus on talking to the guests about projects they've done or shows they've been involved in or anything like that, but rather try and strip away all the showbiz and get down to the essence of the person.
Yeah.
What's been your favorite episode so far? Who's been your favorite guest?
Well, maybe Lewis Black. We talked William James.
Yeah, that was the one about psychics,
That
right?
was the one about psychics. That one was pretty good. I liked the Artie Lang one because we got into suicide and, you know, he tried to commit suicide. And
on the show, he tried to commit suicide.
Yeah, that's midway through.
That's a good friend trying to get your ratings.
Well, thanks. So moderndayphilosophers.net, or search for Danny Lobel with two L's.
We have our one-year anniversary show, which we'll post tonight. I don't know when this posts, but...
Not for a while.
Okay.
three weeks or something.
Well, then 3 weeks ago, we had our one-year anniversary show. Tonight, I'll be posting that with Aisha Tyler.
All right. Next time, we're going to be reading some Ralph Waldo Emerson,
a number
of his famous essays. Well, not you, the rest of us.
I get
the
left
regulars,
out.
Such as Self-Reliance, The American Scholar, Circles. Just look at partiallyexaminedlife.com and you'll see a nice little prompt as to what to read when. Now, folks should be sure to stick around for the song at the end for this one, inspired directly by this episode called Double Negative Theology, featuring violin from my friend Ray Tango. And also, I'm very glad to have on here really nice guitar work from Peter Keel, contributing his part from Holland. We are supported by your donations. Thanks to the big donors and the small continued basis $5 a month citizen donors that get access to our awesome site. And we've got a Facebook page and a Twitter feed, and we've got the blog.
Awesome.
Remember that this episode is brought to you by our good friends at Squarespace.com. Show your support for the Partially Examined Life by heading over to Squarespace.com and sign up for a free trial and 10% off using the offer code EXAMINED at checkout. A better web starts with your website, which in turn helps us. Thanks.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. This was a pleasure. This was a blast.
If there is a God, God is not one. If there is a God, God is not one. But don't try to say what he is, 'cause it does not annoy him a bit. If there were a God, I would not be wrong. Don't think there's a God who would not be strong enough to fix this shit. If he wanted to make things fit, this is not new. If there is a God, God is not through. He puts down his fist, but not really, and pounds us to not good. But don't wait and don't worry, 'cause you're not gonna hear his voice calling you out for your worst mistakes, which you can chalk up to your free choice. If there is a God, God is not good, and you'll never know if you're not understood. And I hate to be so negative, it's not what I would. If there is a